You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Moncler. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we report from Bethlehem, where the city and the Church of the Nativity's inclusion on UNESCO's World Heritage List is being seen as an opportunity for Palestine.
It was very proud. When we did get that, it was like, whoa, we're on the map, you know? It's great. It's just like a kid's feeling when they get an A on their test, you know? It's a great feeling.
Also coming up, seats for takeoff, but you can keep your Kindle on. How the airline's ban on e-readers during takeoff and landing looks set to be overturned. Plus, if it's nearly Christmas, it must be time for a Spanish lottery story. El Gordo is back, and it's fatter than ever. And we'll be taking a trip around one of Berlin's celebrated Christmas markets.
But the markets are just so beautiful and quaint.
So many little towns in Germany are so beautiful and quaint. I think it just sort of mirrors that.
All that, plus we'll take a look back at the big stories of the year from Latin America and play some excellent music too, all here on Midori House. So, lots to squeeze in, but first let's catch up on the latest world news headlines. Here's James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Police in Kenya say raiders have killed 30 people, including several children, and torched their houses in the country's coastal region today. The action heightens security concerns ahead of next year's election. Nine of the raiders were also killed in what appeared to have been a revenge attack by Pokomo farmers against the semi-nomadic Orma pastoralists after a series of clashes in August in which more than 100 people were killed. Supporters of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and his opponents have clashed in the city of Alexandria. The skirmishes come on the eve of a final vote on an Islamist-influenced constitution that's divided the country. Police fired tear gas to separate scores of opponents of the constitution and thousands of Islamists who fought in the rain near a mosque in Alexandria. Health officials said 32 people were injured. The referendum is being held over 2 days because many of the judges needed to oversee polling stayed away in protest. In order to pass, the constitution must be approved by more than 50% of those voting. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country will not be an intermediary between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and those who want him to leave and seek safe haven abroad. The comment comes on the day when Russian President Vladimir Putin holds his first talks with European Union leaders since his re-election as president. The US House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner has said that congressional leaders and President Barack Obama must try to move on from House Republicans' failed tax plan and work together to resolve the looming US fiscal cliff. Mr. Boehner, the top Republican in Congress and Mr. Obama's chief negotiating partner, failed to muster enough support from his fellow Republicans who control the House of Representatives to pass his bill called Plan B. Mr. Boehner outlined how he saw the situation.
We see a situation where because of the political divide in the country, because of the divide here in Washington, trying to bridge these differences has been difficult. If it were easy, I'll guarantee you this would have been done decades before. But we have to find a way to address this significant spending problem that we have, and we need to find a way through tax reform to begin to grow our economy in a way that will create more jobs in our country.
Latest figures show that the West African country Sierra Leone has joined the pack of the bounding African lions among the fastest growing economies in the world. The country has seen a decade of peace after the end of the violent civil war in 2002. Last month, Sierra Leoneans voted in the nation's third election since the war. Although the IMF has forecast growth of 51% next year, around 70% of Sierra Leone's 5.5 million people live below the poverty line, and the Network Movement for Justice and Development is keen to ensure an equal distribution of the country's natural resources. Its chairwoman is Aminata Kelly Lamine.
All we've been asking over the years as advocates is for us to have an opportunity to have a database of exactly the quantum of natural resource we have in country, so that we know when to extract, why we should extract, how we should extract, and when we extract, how we will use the revenues or the resources to benefit equitably every person in this nation.
And a Hong Kong high-end restaurant has been serving end-of-the-world dinners with the promise that customers only have to pick up the bill if the apocalypse doesn't happen. Friday, the 21st of December, today, is the last day in the Mayan calendar, which many have interpreted as the likely end of the world. Most Hong Kong people apparently have not taken the supposed doomsday seriously, and some establishments have seized on the commercial opportunity. One such is Acqua, a high-end Italian restaurant overlooking Victoria Harbour. Here, diners have had the chance to eat a lavish six-course meal with the promise that if the world ends, meals are on the house. Aqua's general manager Simon McKinless explains.
That was a key feature of the evening was, you know, our tagline was, if the world does end, thankfully you won't have to pick up the bill. There was lots of crazy talk when this was decided that we would do, and that's maybe the menu should be $200,000 a head or a crazy number. Obviously, we worked on the date. 21-12-12, so tonight's menu is $2,112.12. So it ties in, and that was given to the chefs to work with that budget.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much. So, of course, it didn't end, and so that's pretty expensive dinner for anybody in Hong Kong.
I know, but it didn't half look nice. Japanese kinky fish were the first course.
Sound excellent. Must get some of them myself. Right, 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here at Monocle in London. Now, first to Bethlehem, which, as well as representing Christmas like few other cities, is celebrating being marked on the World Heritage List. This is the first year that the town's ancient Church of the Nativity has been included, along with Bethlehem's pilgrimage route, as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But as a Palestinian city on the central West Bank, of course, its inhabitants hope that they can use this new status as a way of using soft power to impose international pressure on Israel, as well as helping to boost tourism in the beleaguered area. From O Little Town of Bethlehem, Daniela Peled reports.
Christmas carols in Arabic are playing at full blast across Manger Square in the heart of Bethlehem, where a 50-foot Christmas tree, artificial, festooned with thousands of glowing red baubles, towers over a giant nativity scene. Welcome to the town that invented Christmas, and where there's no tinsel too sparkly, carol too cheesy, or fake snow too fluffy for a local population which, although now majority Muslim, depends on the birth of Jesus for its daily bread. And 2012 brings an extra special Christmas for Palestine. Earlier this year, UNESCO recognised the Church of the Nativity and the pilgrimage route in Bethlehem as Palestine's first ever World Heritage Site, something locals hope will have far-reaching consequences.
It was very proud. When we did get that, it was like, whoa, we're on the map, you know? You know, it's great. It's just like a kid's feeling when they get an A on their test, you know? It's a great feeling, yeah.
Adel Bandak is the owner of the Peace Restaurant, in prime position on Manger Square. Having spent decades working abroad, he's come back to Bethlehem and has big dreams for what the UNESCO status will do for the economy of this town of 29,000 people near Jerusalem.
I can see that there are more countries or more news broadcasters, more media who are now coming more than last year to Bethlehem. Because of that, so we know that the exposure has reached a lot of countries, a lot of people out there, and I think it's going to be getting bigger year by year.
But although this has been a diplomatically significant year for Palestine, only last month the United Nations upgraded its status as an observer member, giving its international standing a major, if largely symbolic, boost. All the businesses in Bethlehem, from the falafel stands to the five-star hotels, still have to deal with the same problems.
Being under occupation still, and being part of Palestine that Palestine has no airports or no ports or does not per se get travelers or visitors on its own. They have to get whatever is assigned by Israel in a way. Some numbers here to that is about 18 to 20 million visitors visit Israel as tourism per year, and about 1.5 million visit Bethlehem. And the 1.5 million that visit, unfortunately speaking, they only visit it for half a day, just to come and see Bethlehem Nativity Church and go back and spend the rest of 7 to 10 days in Israel. So you can imagine, as being a business owner, as hoping for the tourism industry to be a part of your business, it's really a bad, very tough for us businesses here in Palestine, especially in Bethlehem.
Israel says it does its best to facilitate travel to Bethlehem. But sporadic hostilities between Israel and Palestinian militants don't help Bethlehem's brand as the city of peace and the home of Christmas. Most recently, Israel's clashes with Hamas served to deter visitors, even though the conflict in Gaza barely spread to the West Bank. This means that massive investment in Palestine's tourism industry risks going to waste.
The palace was built in 1910, they finished it in 1914. My name is Najib Goshe, I'm general manager of Intercontinental Bethlehem, Jasser Palace. Nobody know the location of Gaza. Everybody know that Gaza is in Palestine. So when the tourists know that they are going to visit Palestine, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Ramallah, all this area, they don't really know. They think that it's in the same area, and we are really far away from Gaza. But we have been affected for sure. What's happening in Gaza in terms of cancellation? We had almost 20% of cancellation in November.
But Palestine's admission as a full member of UNESCO isn't just significant from a tourism perspective. Officials say this will help safeguard Palestine's cultural heritage and are already planning to make use of its right to nominate key historic sites as a tool for political pressure. Next up for candidacy as a UNESCO site is Batir, an area near Bethlehem, where ancient stone wall terraces and a Roman-era irrigation system are currently threatened by Israeli construction of the concrete and steel separation barrier the government says is necessary to protect Israelis from attack. Shireen Sahouri works with the Palestinian Ministry of Antiquities and thinks it's vital that international bodies back up Palestine's territorial claims.
Now we are going to inscribe Batir. Batir, it's a village near Bethlehem here. It's in South Jerusalem because the Israelis, they want to take more lands from this village. It's agricultural terraces, and they want to build the wall there. So if they build the wall, a very important heritage site would be damaged. So if, in case we inscribe this site in the World Heritage List, this will help so much, this site.
Just this week, Israel approved the building of a new settlement of more than 2,600 homes between southern Jerusalem and Bethlehem. In the face of settlement expansion, Shireen says that UNESCO plays a big part in Palestine's soft power arsenal.
Political significant, I think it's that the world has admitted the right of Palestine on this land, even though it's something like thousands of years ago, but for like officially it's the first time.
Back at the Church of the Nativity itself, clouds of incense drift through the interconnecting chapels as pilgrims from all over the world wander through the holy site and tour guides vie for business.
For this is political reasons, what is written here in every book, or the most important, that.
My name is Issa, in the name of Jesus, yeah? You are welcome in our country, in the Holy Land, especially here in the city of Bethlehem. The city, the peaceful city that we are looking to be all the time with all our visitors.
It may be a cliché, but the little town of Bethlehem is really no ordinary place. And this year, its significance is just as political as it is spiritual. For Monocle in Bethlehem, I'm Daniela Peled.
Never has a humble carol sounded so beautiful. Daniela Peled there. You're listening to Midori House. Still to come, Liam Aldous on Spain's infatuation with El Gordo.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair. Keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
Minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. Now, tomorrow marks a big day in Spain. Big, or should we say fat, if you're taking the literal translation of El Gordo, the national lottery event that has the whole country picking their numbers and crossing their fingers. With a top prize of 4 million euros, it's not exactly as valuable as some other lotteries, but what gets Spain going is that El Gordo spreads the wealth, with around 1,800 lucky ticket holders winning tax-free prizes. Well, Liam Aldous is our man in Madrid. Hi, Liam. That last point, tax-free, is important, isn't it? Why?
Well, it's very important because next year it's not going to be tax-free. So this is the last year it's going to be tax-free. It's a new tax the government's obviously putting in. They're trying to get money any place they can, and this is one of the places. But another interesting milestone this year is that it's El Gordo's 200th birthday this year as well, because the lottery stretches back to 1812.
No, okay. Well, we'll talk about that in just a second. But, wow, taxing El Gordo must have been pretty unpopular.
Well, there's a lot of unpopular decisions going on right now, so it was just that was thrown into the fray, and I think it'll be more unpopular next year when it starts happening, but because this year it's not happening, people are more celebratory.
Okay, so let's talk about those celebrations. What have we got special for the 200th El Gordo?
Well, it's about 2.5 billion euros worth of prizes that are spread out, like you said, across the country. And the one thing that I like about El Gordo is that it's a communal lottery. Like, you go into, you can buy a ticket for 200 euros, but obviously that's quite expensive. So you can actually buy tenths of tickets called decimos. So you go in groups of 10 and you buy a ticket together, and then if you win, you all win the lottery together. So it's not this prospect that you would have if you suddenly became rich and all your friends become jealous and it stretches the relationship. Everyone gets rich together.
Now, where are the tickets for El Gordo sold? Are those the ones that we see that old gentlemen on the street selling, or do you have to go somewhere to get them?
Yes, they're all around the street in the plazas, and there's some lottery stands that are more popular than others. So you
Okay, the lucky stands. Tell us about this.
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon because there's one stand in particular in Madrid that's famous for giving away. Quite a few people have won there. So people stretch out 2 months in advance, and the line is so long that the shops along the streets near Callao in the center of Madrid, the shops actually get quite annoyed, so they've actually hired people, ushers, to stop them blocking the shops, and all these people line up. But I don't think they realize that the more people that buy that from there, well, it actually diminishes the prospect of them winning, but they still line up regardless.
So what is the attraction? I mean, obviously it's winning, but is it just the smaller amounts of money that people are looking forward to perhaps being more likely to win, or the fact that they could get the 4 million themselves?
I think everyone goes in for the big one. It's also a big tradition. It's the Christmas lottery. Obviously, it's been going for 200 years. And everyone wakes up on the 22nd of December, which this year falls on a Saturday, to these, which were once orphans calling out the numbers, but now they're just children from a primary school. And they call them out in this very whiny voice, this long, elongated voice. It's actually quite a ceremony. It goes for 3 hours, and everyone is gathered around televisions on the 22nd. So that's what's going to happen tomorrow.
It goes for three. So the program goes for 3 hours. The drawing is that long.
That long.
Okay.
There's some other interesting stories that I found from last year's lottery that are quite interesting. One town actually, the whole town won. So about 200 people in the town actually won about 120 million euros worth of prizes, except for one man. And the reason for him not winning was in a town called Sodeto in the Huesca region, is because the Housewives Association that actually went door to door and sold all the tickets were too lazy to go out of town to his house. He lived in a house out of town, and the whole town won except him. So he's actually a Greek migrant. His name's Kostis Mitsolakis, and instead of getting all bitter about it, he's decided to make a documentary about how the money has changed the town and how much of a bad run he had. So maybe he will make a little bit of money with his documentary.
Okay, well, we hope so. At least that's one story. Another story is that ticket sales on the internet evidently have increased.
Yeah, well, there are some the ticket sales in Spain have decreased a little, but there are a lot of expats. Obviously, there's a huge exodus of Spanish workers going overseas and around Europe right now. So they've been buying their tickets online. So you might see a few lucky winners in London or even Germany, but that won't keep the television crews here in Spain happy, because usually on the day they're on the hunt to hear who's won, and they quickly dispatch and try and get as much footage as they can. So if we've got some winners in other countries, it's not going to make for good television.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens tomorrow. We have a lucky ticket, we hope, in the office. It's 73.266. Do you have a lucky number?
No, I was hoping that you were about to say that you bought me a ticket, but no, I'm actually not participating. I'm not a betting man. I'm an objective journalist. I'm going to stay out of this one and report the story, not become the story.
Okay. Well, interesting you say it as a betting man. That's a whole different different discussion to have, because clearly the Spanish don't really see it as betting themselves, do they?
Well, no. I mean, Spain is a bit of a paradox. Obviously, people see it as a very Catholic country, but the reality on the ground isn't necessarily that way. So the fact that this is a Christmas lottery is quite interesting, because obviously gambling is shunned. But the Virgin Mary and little baby Jesus are actually printed on the tickets. So there is still a religious connection with the lottery. So we'll have to interview the head of the Lottery Commission about that interesting fact.
Okay, well, have fun watching the three-hour spectacular. I'm sure it'll make a very interesting Saturday night in. I wouldn't recommend it myself, but you will see what happens. Liam Aldous, who is Monocle's man in Madrid. Thank you very much. 23 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
24 minutes past the hour. Now, every day this week on Midori House, we've been welcoming in our editors to Studio One here to help us take stock and mull over the year that was in their patch. Well, today we're joined by Monocle's Edits editor, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi, who has been keeping a close eye on events in Latin America. Welcome, Santiago. So, lots to talk about. So many different economies, countries, social, economic issues, everything else. Where should we start? Perhaps in Venezuela?
Yeah, let's start there. Because although it is a very big region and each country is very independent and I think that the great story here was Chavez, because Chavez is such an important figure that somehow unites all the countries, whether it is in favor or against of the United States. And the main story was his illness. And although having been diagnosed with cancer earlier this year, President Hugo Chavez didn't slow down his re-election campaign. And in between treatments and surgery in Cuba, he still managed to beat his contender, Enrique Capriles. Mm. That means he will be in power for 6 more years.
If he makes it.
If he makes it, that's the thing. His illness has worsened, and he is back in Cuba receiving further treatment. On the other side, Capriles managed to secure a seat. He was reelected the governor of the Miranda state, one of the most important states in the country.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? I know there are a lot of people asking the question whether Chavez himself, his doctors, his advisors knew more than they let on when the elections took place in October.
Yeah, I think that's always the problem with presidents getting ill. And if you have followed the Latin American news, he's not the only president that has been ill this year. President Santos in Colombia as well. President Lula da Silva and other presidents have suffered cancer and surgeries. And it's always until last minute that they let the public know. Or they also, as you just mentioned, they keep out some of the news and don't share the full story.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about, you mentioned President Santos, and there was a summit of the Americas in Cartagena. I mean, one of the many, you know, drugs is always going to be, he's discussing the end to the war on drugs, but it's always going to be an issue, and indeed Colombia had it with themselves. But what do you think that story really, where did we get with that?
Well, President Santos, I just read, he was voted the most influential person in the world by El País, the Spanish newspaper. And it's mainly because of that, because he has been one of the most forward-thinking head of states. And he has proposed, just as he did in the sixth version of the summit that was held in Cartagena earlier this year, that drugs should be decriminalized and there should be a new approach to this problem, and think of it more as a health issue rather than a criminal issue. And he's managed to recruit many followers and some support from other nations in Latin America.
Well, because it's long suspected that actually it's the better way to go, rather than putting the power into the criminal gangs. Actually, if you take that element out of it, then you know, you might be able to solve the problem a different way. But drugs have also been on the issue, one of the issues, but marijuana this time in Uruguay, and Jose Mujica, I think it is, the poorest president in the world.
Exactly. Tell us about that. Pepe Mujica. He's known fondly as Pepe. It has made the headlines this year because he donates 90% of his salary. He drives a 1982 Volkswagen Beetle. He lives in a farm in the outskirts of Montevideo. And he gave a very, very brave and strong speech at the Rio+20 summit. Everybody was talking about sustainability, about eco-friendly technologies. And he narrowed down to asking all the 139 or plus members that were attending the summit if they were happy. Happiness. What is the key to happiness? And he thinks that by legalizing marijuana, he will stop the gangs taking over his country, as they have, for example, affected Argentina and Bolivia and Peru, and some other countries in the region. Unfortunately, this new decree didn't pass in the past few days, because as he said, to quote him, he thinks that the Uruguayan population is still not mature enough to embrace this new policy. But again, it's another representation of how Latin America wants to change the drug war and finally end it and give it a spin and have a new objective for next year and years to come.
Okay, well, talking of finally, Santiago, we've only got about 20 seconds left, but it's been quite a year for news in Latin America, hasn't it? From the corruption trials and arrests in Brazil to still in Colombia, the discussions between the FARC rebels and the government there. It seems like we're just going to get even more stories in 2013.
Oh, yeah, the region just keeps on giving, and you will hear everything from drug wars to peace signing to football and models, the way it always is.
Okay, brilliant. Monocle's Santiago Rodriguez Toditi there, our editor on the year's news in Latin America. Thank you very much. As I said, we're heading towards the bottom of the hour. The news headlines will be next. As I said, we're at the bottom of the hour. In the next half hour of the programme, how the world's London correspondents reported the year's events, and we'll also explore why the Christmas market is so important to German holiday spirits. But first, it's time for news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Police in Kenya say raiders have killed 30 people, including several children, and torched their houses in the country's coastal region. The action heightens security concerns ahead of next year's election. We're also just getting reports that four people have been shot dead on a road in rural Pennsylvania. Supporters of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and his opponents have clashed in the city of Alexandria. The skirmishes come on the eve of a final vote on an Islamist-influenced constitution that's divided the country. Police have fired tear gas to separate scores of opponents of the constitution and thousands of Islamists who fought in the rain near a mosque in Alexandria. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says his country will not be an intermediary between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and those who want him to leave and seek safe haven abroad. The comment comes on the day when Russian President Vladimir Putin has been holding his first talks with European Union leaders. And the US House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner has said that congressional leaders and President Barack Obama must try to move on from House Republicans' failed tax plan and work together to resolve the looming US fiscal cliff. Mr. Boehner, the top Republican in Congress and Mr. Obama's chief negotiating partner, failed to muster enough support from his fellow Republicans who control the House of Representatives to pass his bill called Plan B. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much. James will be back in about 28 minutes' time. So before we get on to some more news and current events of the day and reviews of 2012, let's get a bit of music. This is Break of Day by Tina Dico. Tina Dico and Break of Day. 36 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House. Now, next, we have a story that could affect many of us travelling this holiday season. In the US, the Federal Aviation Administration is coming under pressure to allow the constant use of e-readers on commercial flights. At present, passengers can use devices such as Kindles, iPads and Nooks while in flight, but not during takeoff and landing. Now a US senator is threatening legislation if the FAA don't change their rules on the electronic devices, with a widespread view being that the ban makes no sense because e-readers do not transmit data. Well, we're joined now by Peter Morris, chief economist at aviation consultancy Ascend Worldwide. Hi, Peter. Thanks for joining us. Have you always wondered why they say turn every electronic device on, no matter what it does on takeoff or landing?
Yes, I think there's probably a lot of business passengers have wondered quite what the effect is, particularly those who have left their phones on inadvertently and found that the plane didn't drop from the sky. So I think there's something for science to contribute as to what it is any kind of interference could be. And I think the evidence as such seems quite limited that there is an impact. But when you're talking about the e-readers, it really becomes difficult to understand whether that is a petty regulation or have any science behind it.
Indeed, because with mobile phones, I think the general view, isn't it, amongst the governments, the transportation bodies and indeed the airlines, is that until it's proved that they definitely don't have an effect on aircraft's navigation systems, they're not going to take the chance. And that's probably a sensible view.
Yes, although I suppose the contrarian view would be it's a bit like putting salt at the end of your garden to keep the elephants away. You know, how do you actually test that particular hypothesis?
Yeah, unless you hold them very close. I mean, I guess if you had them in the cockpit, and there's no way of us knowing if pilots themselves turn their mobile phones off, although it'd probably be best practice to do so, then it might interfere with their radios, perhaps.
Well, I think there's a whole raft of issues coming along, particularly with Wi-Fi on board, that, yes, you're talking about different spectrums and so on, but nonetheless, you are talking about signals being present with the encouragement, obviously, of the airline that, in many cases, is seeking to market and retail that service to its passengers. So it can hardly be saying you shouldn't be using it when it's trying to push the concept of Wi-Fi.
Indeed, a very, very good point you make. Now, let's turn then to these e-readers. And this discussion and debate that's happening between these two US agencies of government, the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Aviation Administration, so two bodies having a go each other on something they both feel quite strongly about.
Yes, I think it's back to your point as to what the degree of substantiation of any impact is. And quite honestly, I'm not sure anyone is able to stand up and make any scientific case for an e-reader interfering with anything. So I suspect part of the problem is by banning everything electronic, it's a lot easier in terms of enforcement than, say, well, it's this particular brand or this particular sub-brand that's allowed and this other one isn't. It starts to get very difficult to actually enforce that in any way.
Do you think part of it is also that the airlines themselves, and let's not forget, it's not the airlines who make up the rules on what you can and can't use. That tends to be regulatory bodies like the FIA, the FAA, although the airlines can put whatever the rules they want, of course, on their own planes. But do you think some of them might not want people to be reading because they want them to pay attention to the safety briefing?
It's possible. I mean, again, you've got the sort of takeoff and landing. I think we've all come across the situation where on one airline you land and you're told it's perfectly okay to turn on your mobile. On another one, you're strictly banned until you're at the terminal building. And, you know, that has to lead to confusion to say, well, why is it different at this airport? And, of course, it isn't. And it is a bit debatable as to whether there's any kind of impact on the ground that would, while the airplane is driving around, that was likely to occur.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens with that. And Peter, we've got about 25 seconds left. What would you say, looking back on 2012, were some interesting, or maybe the main points? We've seen the entry into service of the Boeing 787, a plane that has its own problems, and then the rise of the Asian and the Gulf carriers. What would you say was sort of the key story of the year for you?
Beginning of the time of transition, both in terms of the type of aircraft and who operates them, and the kind of levels of services. So looking back, even though 2012 looks like a bumping on along the bottom year, similar to the economy, I think that in airline terms, it's probably going to be seen as something of a turning point where the first signs of changes of alliances, aggregation of carriers ticked in the US and so on, have been seen. And people realize that was the point where different things started to happen and we ended up with a smaller, more expensive industry.
Oh, okay. Interesting stuff. Thank you very much. Peter Morris, Chief Economist at aviation consultancy Ascend Worldwide. We'll see what kind of effect that has on us, the paying passenger. 42 minutes past, just turned 43, in fact, minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, just a few days ago, here at Midori House, London's finest foreign correspondents descended on Monocle HQ for a Christmas tipple. Monocle's Adrian Craddock was there to mingle with our guests and discuss what they saw as the biggest news stories in 2012.
I'm Keiko Fujino. I work for one of the main Japanese broadcasters in their London bureau as a news producer.
So what do you think has been the biggest story for Japan in 2012?
Well, I think the island disputes between Korea and China, they've dominated quite a lot. It's still obviously a very highly contested issue. I think that'll continue on. But, you know, it's something that for us, it erupts every few years. But Japan's got an election coming up on Sunday, actually, and it seems like it's going to... A lot of people are moving much more towards the right, and we've got quite a kind of center-left government at the moment, so it'll be interesting to see how it kind of results.
And what do you think will be the big story of 2013, if you could look ahead in your crystal ball?
I'm kind of looking out to see what's going to happen to Syria. It's within our coverage area. I was there in Damascus in March. You know, and there's a kind of media blackout at the moment. People are getting in, but there's not much information coming out.
And do you think that 2012 has really been a year of recovery for Japan? I mean, obviously, after that horrible earthquake, it seems like, you know, there were terrible wounds throughout Japan. Is that fair to say that 2012 has really been a year of recovery?
Yes, definitely, I think. I think, you know, since March 2011 when it happened, everyone's been recovering. But I think also I went to go volunteer in the affected region in Tohoku only for a couple of days when I went back to Japan last time, which was about a year ago. But even then, I think people there are really worried that they're getting forgotten about. And I think Japan really needs to kind of keep up the momentum of trying to help and sort out the area and, you know, not forget about those people who are there, really.
And how do you think Japan's perception of the UK has changed over 2012? Do you think it has?
Well, the Olympics, that was massive, obviously. Japan loves the Summer Olympics. It was huge news for us. We were like Olympic crazy this whole year. I've been preparing it for months. I was the main producer in the London Bureau. So I think in that way this year, it's definitely had a really positive outcome. It's been very successful, obviously, within the UK. Even in Japan, there were a lot of tourists. We didn't do as well in the medal table as we thought we, well, as we wanted to, really. But I think very much a positive outlook towards the UK this year for Japan.
And just finally, you know, one of the big stories of 2012 was Obama being elected. How do you think his election will affect Japan? Do you think Japan are happy about him being back in power, or were they rooting for Romney?
I think since it's become Obama, I mean, Japanese Prime Minister has tended to be quite close to Bush. But I think Obama's maybe kind of taken a step back with its relations with Japan. So I don't think we're necessarily disappointed, but I don't know if we're particularly, you know, we're thinking that it's going to create some massive change.
My name is Alexander Smotrov, and I work in London as a correspondent for the Russian news agency RIA Novosti.
And what do you think has been the biggest story of 2012 for Russia? What has been the biggest story within your country?
I think the story which had repercussions both domestically and internationally was this Pussy Riot story. We can't say if it was positive or negative, but it was the big, big story.
Do you think that story was a problem for Russia in some ways, as in the way it was perceived? It may have looked a bit bad internationally, or you're not too concerned about that?
Yeah, I think this story was quite bad publicity for many aspects of Russian government and Russian life. But on the other hand, it just attracted another interest for Russia, not only in terms of politics, but in terms of arts and just relationship between the arts and the state. And so I think in this sense, it was quite a positive one.
And, you know, living in the UK, do you think that Russia's perception of the UK has changed at all since you've been here?
Yes, I think so. And Britain in general is very popular among Russians. So you just go go around in Moscow and you see how many Union Jacks you can see on people's T-shirts or bags. So in general, British style, British design, and I hope in some sense British way of thinking is quite popular in Russia. And there are a lot of different organizations, private and public, which do contribute into this promotion. And I will be happy if they do more, and Britain will be setting quite a good trendy example for Russia.
Adrian Craddock there with the London correspondents from around the world. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, each and every Christmas, German cities across the country devote the month before the holidays to their traditional Weihnachtsmarkt, or Christmas market, a festive mix of family, friends, last-minute gifting, roast chestnuts, hot glühwein and warm cheer. As long-standing cultural events, some Christmas markets date back centuries. Melanie Sevchenko bundled up against the frosty chill of Berlin's pre-holiday cold front to meet up with locals, tourists and Christmas market vendors to sample the Yuletide treats and to get to the bottom of why Weihnachtsmarkt is so essential to the German Christmas spirit.
For an upscale market, the Weihnachtsauber occupies the refined Gendarmenmarkt just off of Berlin's Fashionista Friedrichstrasse. Covered stalls offer gourmet specialties and luxury handmade goods, offering much more than the standard kitsch. On a slushy Saturday afternoon, the Weihnachtsauber is bustling with Berliners and visitors, brandishing Bavarian bread, bratwurst, and baked goods. A hefty queue has formed from the Neuburger Rahmbrot stand, where tray after tray of Rahmbrot are being pulled from massive four-door ovens.
It's black bread. Germany, schwarzes Brot.
But what's the special recipe?
Sour cream and ham and Zwiebeln. What is Zwiebeln?
Yeah, onions.
Onions. Hmm.
Delicious. Moving from vendor to vendor, I spot every imaginable Christmas delicacy. Steaming crepes stuffed with jam and chocolate, frosty glasses of Hefeweizen, piping hot mugs of glühwein, dried apple chips, roasted nuts, handmade spreads and olive oils. And of course, marzipan, at the Marzipan and Nougateria vendor.
We sell marzipan and nougat, obviously. And we have a very high quality base mass, I guess you would call it. It's this one here. Since marzipan is made from purely almonds, water and sugar, right? So this has an almond content of almost 60%. And based on that, we just kind of, you know, mix it with interesting stuff like this, chocolate and chili or orange and some alcohol or, you know, different, just try different things. People associate marzipan and nougat with Christmas. The cold is good for a product and, you know, it just melts in summer. So that's a plus. And people give it as gifts.
Gifts are indeed a large part of perusing the Christmas markets. Venturing out of the cold wind and into the warmer indoor portion of the Weihnachtsauber, I met with aisles of artisan crafts, Everything from designer handbags and jewelry, luxury goods and cosmetics, to glassworks and textiles, wooden toys and games. Apparently, it's quite difficult to secure a booth in here. You have to prove your craft with years of professional experience, not to mention a costly fee. At a corner vendor selling porcelain figurines and balsam wood Christmas ornaments, a carpenter chips away at a massive wooden statue of a nativity goat. At another vendor, I meet Alexis, who's selling handmade stuffed animals and clothes for little children and babies under the Danish brand name Lille Knus, or the Little Hug. Alexis says this year marks his fourth year at the Weihnachtsaube, but he says the general spirit of the German Christmas market is changing.
Christmas in Germany, people used to come to get together to have a nice glass of wine and warm wine and eat something and just meet outside just before the Christmas time, 4 weeks before Christmas time, what they call Adventzeit. It's 4 Sundays before Christmas. I don't know what it's so special about it now, to be honest. I think it's more commercial stuff now. And if you really look at the stuff, the most of the stuff is for the parents and not for the children. Christmas is supposed to be something for children also. This market where you are now, Gendarmenmarkt, is a special market because most of the people who are here are hand workers, the handicraft men. Everybody does their own stuff. It's all handmade. Like this guy in front is making his own pens and stuff like that out of wood. It's more artisan. Personally, I don't like Christmas markets anymore. They used to be nice and cozy, but now it's just more commercial stuff.
Later in the night, I head over to the less commercial Lucia Christmas Market, which is nestled in the courtyard of the historic Kulturbrauerei, a former East German brewery in the Prenzlauerberg district. Considered one of the most beautiful Christmas markets in the capital, the romantic elegance of the Lucia is inspired by Nordic Scandinavian traditions. Surrounding the 50 Christmas market stalls is a warm and cozy ambience, complete with spirits and regional food, like grünkohl and knacker. There's even a sauna for those who want to beat the chill alpine style, along with a bungee trampoline and carousel for children. I meet up with Robertson McIlwin and BJ Herrmann, both Berlin residents who have come to warm their spirits with Christmas cheer and Glühwein. I asked them what makes a Weihnachtsmarkt so essential to the German Christmas experience.
That would probably have to be the Glühwein.
I think it's the festive atmosphere.
There's the festive atmosphere, but you do have to take into account that the festive atmosphere is about 90% Glühwein. Oh, we should totally go to the one in Spandau tomorrow. There's like 400 booths or something.
I don't want to see that. That's not the point.
What's the point?
I don't know. It's hanging out with your friends and it's like being warm while it's cold. Well, the thing about a Christmas market is in a way that everybody gets tipsy and everybody's uncomfortable, but everybody gets comfortable. It's like a sauna outdoors where you get drunk.
I mean, all the beer gardens are closed during the winter, so unless you're drinking something warm, it's hard to drink outside during the winter in Berlin.
That said, we go on a walk to get more Glühwein.
6 euro with the Pfand for euch.
I might just try the traditional one.
Thanks. 2 euros, please.
Do you want to tell me what's in Glühwein?
The red wine, made out of the grape wine. And vanilla, cardamom, and nutmeg. Ours is with nutmeg, not everyone's with nutmeg.
It's nice. Simple.
My Glühwein is handed to me in a classic decorative boot-shaped mug, a traditional collector's cup of the Weihnachtsmarkt.
That's a really essential part of Christmas markets, is collecting stupid cups, and when it's June, you're really happy that they finally break.
Yes.
That's essential. Mm-hmm.
Sarah, a waitress at one of Berlin's most touristic restaurants and venues, is also standing by the Glühwein tent.
They are beautiful. I mean, I think this one's my favorite one in Berlin.
but they're also traditional. And I know people that have had stores on markets, and there's often a 7-year waiting list before you can even get a store. And,
wow.
And some of the sausage stands, they earn like a quarter of a million within this like short period. It's amazing, but the markets are just so beautiful and quaint. So many little towns in Germany are so beautiful and quaint. I think it just sort of mirrors that.
The night is winding down, and Robertson and BJ might be on their last Glühwein. But there's one more interesting factoid I learned about the Weihnachtsmarkt.
One Christmas market out of 50 has a camel?
They have camels here.
Really?
No, they had one in Rixdorf.
Camel?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that.
No, they do. They only have it on Sunday, though.
I saw the mules.
So what Christmas market did you want to go to tomorrow?
I thought we were going to Dahlem.
I don't know. I'm kind of Christmas marketed out.
For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
And that's all we have time for today on Midori House. Thanks very much for our producer, Dawn Trump, researcher Pilar Lopez, and studio manager Sam Impey. At 2200 hours London time tonight is the Monocle Daily. And today we'll be running through who's up for the top job at the World Trade Organization and what kind of effort they'll have to do to be successful in the role.
The candidates for the post of Director General should be chosen because of their merits, because of their knowledge of trade policy, because their ability as brokers, as negotiators, because they command respect from ministers and even heads of state.
That's the Monocle Daily tonight, but next week we have a special series of Midori House, as the programme will be coming to you live from St. Moritz, as Tyler Brulé, Sophie Grove, Marcus Hippie and Andrew Tuck ring their sleigh bells in the snow. But from us on this, our 300th Midori House, for now, it's goodbye.